Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast, where you will get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside of legal nurse consulting. They will share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with 30 years experience. So, join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's Pat.
This is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast. I have with me today Jill Gunther, who is working in a labor and delivery postpartum integrated unit in a level one hospital in New York State and does expert witness work in addition to her hands-on clinical role. Jill, welcome to the show.
Hi, Pat. Thank you for having me.
I know that for the legal nurse consultants listening to this program, that if they work in the medical malpractice area, labor and delivery obstetrical cases are viewed as being very high-risk cases with what can be enormous damages with a loss of an infant or a loss of a mother or a mother who sustains significant injury that keeps her incapacitated and unable to take care of her child. So this is an area that you practice in where there's lots of lights that are beamed on the practice of OB and what happens during that intense period in a woman's life. Let's talk about some of the risks that happen after the delivery. I know there's a lot of focus on what can go wrong during labor and delivery, but we shouldn't ignore the fact that there can be risks occurring in the postpartum area that also impact what occurs to the mother, to the infant, to the staff. From your perspective, in the clinical area, what are some of the common risks? We'll start with common, and then we can mention some of the rare, devastating risks. What are some of the common risks in the postpartum area?
Your most common, statistically speaking, is hemorrhage. The Safe Motherhood Initiative, which is a worldwide initiative put together by the World Health Organization, fostered by the Maternal Health Alliance and ACOG and AWON, narrows down like the biggest risk factors, hypertensive crisis, the maternal hemorrhage, VTE, so the venothromboembolisms, and then even amniotic embolism. The Safe Motherhood Initiative narrows it down to your big three: the hemorrhage risk, the hypertensive, and blood clots, because those are like the big three threats. And those threats aren't there only during labor and delivery or the first hour. Those are threats for hours and sometimes even days and weeks after she delivers.
And if we focus on hemorrhage, I know that the women who are listening who have had children know there's a certain amount of drainage that accompanies recovering from delivering a child. What are some of the things that the postpartum nurses should be monitoring for if there's a thought that there could be a hemorrhage, or what should they be observing for to make sure there isn't a hemorrhage occurring?
One of our number one things that we check on is whether or not her uterus stays nice and firm and contracting down on itself to control the flow of blood. So we do, they're called fundal checks, to those of us who don't know all of the little terms. We rub on the uterus. It should feel approximately about like a grapefruit sitting in her lower abdomen in the first days, and then get smaller to about day 10. You can't feel it at all, typically by hand. So it should be remaining firm. And as the days go by, getting lower and lower, we use the umbilicus as like our measuring point. Is, you know, is it above it? Is it below it? Is it to the left of it? Is it to the right of it? It's, that's our focal point. And where's that? That's the primary one. The flow, the vaginal flow coming out, how much blood is it? Is she passing clots? Does she find that instead of it getting less, is it getting more? So those are like, that's like top. And then of course, you watch her for other signs, urinary output and vital signs, of course. Sadly enough, vital signs, even though you would think that that would be one of your number ones, it's like shifts in blood pressure and heart rate for the mom are actually later signs that she may be losing too much blood. So those are good starting points.
And, you know, I think about the way that OB care has changed over the years. It used to be a 5-day admission, and then the number of days progressively decreased. What are your thoughts related to the risks of sending a woman home shortly after delivery, only to have her at home where she's not going to be monitored, in light of the risks that we're talking about?
It makes me nervous. It truly does. Because a woman can be completely stable in the hospital and then end up returning with these complications afterward. One such cause would be like the smallest piece of the placenta can get left inside the uterus inadvertently, you know, because maybe she has a completely uncomplicated vaginal delivery. She delivers the placenta. It looks to be intact. The doctor does, you know, the quick look on the table, or the midwife, the delivering provider, I should say, does, you know, an exam of the placenta, and it looks to be completely intact, but the smallest piece can be sitting up inside of her uterus. And days after she's home, suddenly she's bleeding large quantities. There's usually a foul odor because at this point in time, the tissue is starting to break down. It's a source of infection. It creates a very complex situation for mom where she can be at significant risk. So I worry about making things, you know, this hurry up and get them out kind of healthcare.
Mm-hmm. What are the responsibilities of the postpartum nurse when she's doing discharge instructions to explain what to look for?
Teaching the mom about what her uterus should feel like. We can teach them, we should teach them how to do their own fundal checks. You know, what should your uterus feel like? And what should it feel like tomorrow and the next day, so that they know as it gets smaller, that's a normal finding, that whenever they rub it, it should feel firm, or within one or two rubs, it should feel firm. She should know that draining her bladder regularly is very important, because when the bladder and the uterus have to kind of vie for space in the pelvis, the bladder will almost always win, and then the uterus won't be able to control its bleeding. It'll get softer. It won't be able to maintain that firmness with the bladder pushing on it. What her bleeding should be like. You know, it's not uncommon for changes in bleeding to accompany increases in activity as she slowly starts to do more things at home. But does the bleeding go back to a more slower or settled pace when she sits down and relaxes and puts her feet up for a little bit? Blood clots, is she passing any, you know, small little blood clots, or particularly when she first gets out of bed in the morning or after laying down for a few hours, aren't necessarily abnormal. Are they getting bigger? Is there a foul odor? Foul odors are a huge sign that you need to get checked for some, to make sure there's not infection going on in your uterus.
Yeah. And it sounds to me like when the staff do this teaching and the mom recognizes that there's something wrong, that then from a liability perspective, since we're looking at this as legal nurse consultants, the mom calls the midwife or the obstetrician and says, this is what's happening. What happens if the midwife or the obstetrician doesn't recognize or dismisses what the mom is saying?
That would be highly concerning. That is definitely something that, as a legal nurse consultant, I would highlight for the legal team to take a deeper in-depth look at. If a mother were to call and say, you know, my bleeding is increasing, or I'm passing clots and I wasn't before, I'm having pain, there's an odor, and she's not directed to either come into the office, the maternity unit, depending on how their policies and protocols work with postpartum women, local ER or urgent care, you know, it's like different organizations set that up differently as to where they would want these women evaluated. But if they're not having them evaluated, I would be extremely concerned for the care that she's receiving.
And then before we leave the subject of blood loss, because I think that's an easy issue for a jury to understand. There's nothing subtle about bleeding excessively. Right. I know that there's when a surgeon does a surgery, and the anesthesiologist will get an agreement together about this was the estimated blood loss. Let's say there was a cesarean that was done. Tell me about the quantitative blood loss and how that's measured.
The standard of care for obstetric teams is to do the quantitative blood loss. So quantitative blood loss is considered a much more accurate reflection of blood that is lost. Statistics and research blatantly demonstrated that there was a chronic underestimation of blood loss, particularly in hemorrhages and in deliveries and in cesarean sections, even ones that were considered uncomplicated. They would look at the blood loss and say, oh, she lost 300, 500, but when compared to actual quantitative blood loss, she lost 1,000, 1,200, 1,500, which under current standards is considered hemorrhage. So for quantitative blood loss, like in my particular organization, we have paper disposable products, very little fabric, you know, there's sheets on the bed, which are fabric. So with those, we take a bunch of fabric items, we weigh them, and we take the average known weight for those. But all of our other paper products are like standardized. The papers that we use directly under our mothers that are highly absorbent, it's all standardized. The peri pads, everything. Some people think of the we call them mommy diapers because they're cute. It's like it depends. We know the exact weight of those. So when they're filled with blood, if I were to weigh one and it weighs 400 grams on our scales, which we conveniently have all over the unit, thank you to our babies. But the pad itself, I know only actually weighs 100 grams. 1 gram equals 1 milliliter. So that 400 gram pad is 300 cc's of blood that she's lost. But we do that with like every little thing, 4x4s, lap pads, the pads that cover the OR table, like every little piece of paper that you could think of that might be in an OR or in a delivery room, we know the dry weight of, like the weight without any fluid in it, so that we can compare and process out and know what she's truly losing. That's quantitative blood loss.
Wow. And is this on a wall chart? Is this in your computer documentation system? Where do you store those normal weights for those units?
Our computer documentation system actually has an area where you can let the computer do that. A bunch of our dry weights are in there specifically. A lot of our staff do it by, it's not a wall chart. There are small little charts hanging from all of our scales that tell us what those dry weights are of the standard items that we use regularly. Mm-hmm. So most of us will just be able to look right down and, you know, take that peri pad, you know, for instance, look down and say, oh, this is 400. Oh, the pad weighs at 300, and you can put the 300 directly into our computer system. And our old computer system, you would just go under the INO setting and you would go to blood and you would put in 300. Our current system has a specific spot for QBL for pregnant women, which mm-hmm. is really nice because it sets it apart from any other INOs that she's taken. It sets it apart, and yet you can incorporate it, I should say, really. It's nice. I like that it does that. So
mm-hmm. Technology is wonderful.
Technology is fabulous.
Before we continue the podcast, please spend a few minutes getting to know one of the guest speakers who will be presenting at our September 23, 24, 25, 2021 Virtual Legal Nurse Consulting Conference. After you have a chance to meet this guest, we'll resume the podcast. This is Pat Iyer, and I am pleased to bring to you Dr. Peter Salgo, who is on the staff teaching resident and intern physicians about anesthesia, about being an intensivist, and about medicine. He is a professor at Columbia University and works full-time taking care of patients. Peter is going to be one of the speakers who will be joining us for our September 23, 24, and 25, 2021 Legal Nurse Consulting Virtual Conference. Peter, I'm so pleased to have you with me today as we talk with our viewer about some of the highlights of what you're going to cover when you are presenting your talk for us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
When we discussed this topic initially, we were going on the concern that many attorneys have about whether there is indeed pain and suffering after a person has been injured. And we could be involved in cases that involve a short period where a person's injured and died, or extended long days, weeks, and months of pain and suffering. Can you give our viewers some of the highlights of what you're going to be covering when you're speaking to our legal nurse consultants?
Well, sure. I think it's probably best to start off with a definition. What is pain? What is suffering? How do we appreciate that neurologically? What does it mean to us emotionally? And then we have to break it down a little bit. What causes pain? Clearly, if there's been an injury, then there are signals which are going from the injured area to the brain. How do they get there? How do we appreciate this? How does the brain analyze this? What does the brain need to have to understand the nature of the injury and to experience the pain and the suffering? Then we need to evaluate, obviously, the neurologic pathways. We need to evaluate the consciousness, which is maintained or not maintained. And a lot of this can be gleaned from the circumstances of the accident, for example, if it is an accident. The police reports, the EMT reports, often you'll have video of what happened so that you can actually see what's going on. In today's world, a great deal of what we do is recorded, whether we know it or not. The cameras are out there. And then when the victim is taken into some sort of medical facility, it could be as simple as an EMT response at the scene, or later when transferred to a hospital, you're going to get a lot more information. And this information is physical exams, it's going to be laboratory results, and then an awful lot of nurses' notes. And I've always found that the truth is always somewhere buried in the chart. And often the best place to look is the nurses' notes. Doctors come by and they do a great job. They drop in they evaluate patients, and then they go on and do the rest of their daily business. Nurses stay at the bedside. And so for a really good look at what's happened to a patient, you often simply go to the nurse's notes and read them. And, you know, I can't tell you the number of times an attorney has called me and said, I'm going to send you the chart. You don't need the nurse's notes. I'll just send you the quick stuff. And I said, no, please don't. Send me the important stuff, which is often the fine print, the detail inside a chart. So the nurses often record the mental status, the nurses record the pain scores. And then you have to use your judgment from as a physician reviewing these charts as to what happened. What happened in the hospital? What procedures were performed? Do they hurt? What kind of an anesthetic was provided? And were they able, given the clinical situation, to provide enough medication to be sure that there's no pain and no suffering? Because often these patients are hypotensive. And as we know, when you give medication to control pain, you drop the blood pressure. And so it's always a desperate kind of balancing act between medication and blood pressure, and the patient is sort of caught in the middle. So it's going to be an interesting discussion to discuss how to go through a chart, understand where the pain is coming from, what it means to the person, understand how the chart records this. And then going forward, I think it's always useful to try to make a judgment as to if the patient survives and goes forward, whether there's permanent disability, whether the person understands the disability and what this means emotionally, and certainly if there's continuing pain, what this means to a patient going forward after the event. So it's complicated, but the devil's in the details. The details are in the chart, and often those chart details are in the nurse's notes.
You are so right. When I think about all the assessments that nurses make and the various pain scores, the detail of symptoms, of measurements of wounds, of drainage, there's a plethora of details. Legal nurse consultants are trained and rewarded for being detail oriented and being able to pull out those pieces for the attorneys they're working with. Your perspective as a physician is in this area is fascinating, and we'll talk about how you look at pain and suffering versus how an LNC would look at pain and suffering, where you shine in this world, and how you can help attorneys.
Sure. And it's also worth noting that the medication records are important. That's certainly part of the nurse's notes, but you've got to take a look at exactly which medications were given when. And, as one example, you've got to look at whether or not paralytics were given, vecuronium, rocuronium, succinylcholine. Once those are on board, then a lot of the information and clues that you've got as to the patient's state of comfort is removed. And so a nurse's note that says, you know, zero pain has to be correlated to what medications were given. Paralytics on board, well, then we have to reevaluate that.
Yeah, that's a great point. I so look forward to having you as one of our speakers at our conference. And be sure, if you have not signed up for this conference, please go to this link, http://lnc.tips/September2021virtual. That link is right below this video and on this video, so you can't miss it. And we will see you at the conference.
It's going to be fun. Thank you.
Now you've had a chance to meet one of our esteemed speakers for our September 23, 24, and 25, 2021 Legal Nurse Consulting virtual conference planned by Barbara Levin and I for you. Be sure to get your seat reserved at this link, http://lnc.tips/September2021virtual. I'll see you there. You mentioned a couple of different kinds of clots when we're talking about high-risk issues affecting postpartum patients. You talked about blood clots, and you talked about amniotic fluid embolism. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about the blood clot prevention, since, you know, that is something that affects every woman? And then I want to talk a little bit about the amniotic fluid embolism and the impact on the woman. Let's start with, what are the preventative measures that are in place according to what should be the standard of care for preventing blood clots or the VTEs?
Well, minimizing the amount of time in bed is number one. Women, when they are pregnant and in their first weeks of postpartum, are in a hypercoagulable state. They have a higher risk for blood clots than the average woman who doesn't have any, you know, of course, clotting risk factors. That being said, you don't want to put them on bed rest for long periods of time and keep them there. There's research and suggestions for practice out there that state even a woman with an epidural in labor should have the sequential compression stockings placed on her legs to help with blood flow. If her epidural is, say, dense enough that she can't move her legs at all. Mm-hmm. The practice that works in my hospital, the anesthesia practice, I should say, they're really excellent in the way they do their epidurals. It's very rare that our women cannot still move their legs, flex their feet. They are active in helping us with repositioning them. We, of course, are very careful and we guide them. We don't, needless to say, want them falling out of bed or getting injured in any way, shape, or form, but they're not so dense with their epidurals that they can't move at all. Postpartum, after, say, cesarean section, we are getting women out of bed 6 to 8 hours after surgery, whereas women who had surgery or other types of surgery, I'm sure elsewhere in the hospital, we're getting people out of bed sooner. We start our sequential compression stockings in the operating room before she's even started. As soon as we place the spinal and as soon as we lay her down, the devices are on, the machine is on, we're starting, because we don't want to run the risk, even during the short period of time that she cannot move her legs during a cesarean section. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the biggest. Women who have known coagulopathies, there are, they'll come in during the perinatal period. They're started on Lovenox, switched over to heparin, things of that nature, because they have some type of known issue with clotting, whether they clotted before or, you know, they have some type of medical condition. So there's mm-hmm. various ways. SCDs are one of our number one for clots, though.
Mm-hmm. And that certainly is a change. That level of aggressiveness is new and reflecting what we know about preventing blood clots. The type of clot or the embolism, the amniotic fluid embolism, always catches the attention of attorneys because of the outcomes that can result from that. Can you share with our listener who might not be familiar with amniotic fluid embolism, why is this such a dreaded condition?
You don't see it coming. It can happen while she's pregnant or shortly thereafter, more times than not in the delivery room area as opposed to the postpartum period. And it's deadly. It's like a shot from a gun. You don't hear it coming. You don't see the weapon. Your mom is talking to you. She might look at you and say, huh, something feels funny. Maybe if you're lucky, she'll give you that warning. And then she's unconscious. And if you don't have highly trained staff that are prepared to think outside the box. When we talked previously, Pat, I had told you that if I had a woman losing consciousness in front of me, my first thought would be like, is she hemorrhaging? My second thought might be, is she about to seize? Because those are the more common, you know, your preeclampsia, eclampsia, your hemorrhaging, those are your more common. Amniotic fluid embolism is going to be like third or fourth. I mean, yes, I'm going to be calling my code team and I'm going to be yelling for help, but it's just so rare and so insidious and happens so fast. It's not always the first thing. And if you don't act quickly, or even if you do act quickly, mom's prognosis can be very poor. And it's not going to necessarily be because the staff didn't do everything they could and do it in a timely basis. It's a rough one. It's very rough.
And I think for that reason, it captures the attention of the legal teams because it happens quickly. Is it preventable? The results are terrible. There's a newborn baby who's growing up without a mother. And the team are sitting there looking at each other saying, what just happened? It's like a train.
Yeah.
Coming through the postpartum unit, and no one is prepared for what's going to come barreling down that track.
Exactly.
So certainly a legal nurse consultant could be asked to evaluate a case in which a woman died suddenly from an amniotic fluid embolism and be asked to determine, is there anything that could have been done to prevent that outcome?
Yeah, they could be asked. You know, and that legal nurse consultant would just, I mean, I would, if somebody told me that happened and they asked me to look at the case, I'll look at the case. I would, you know, say, you know, well, they did this in a time and this in a time and they did all of these things. And, you know, mom still didn't make it. There's not something else you can do per se. Or I would say, well, why didn't they do this within this amount of time? It's like, you can always look at it, you know, sadly enough, what was that big article all those years ago, to err is human. It can happen, but a lot of times there's not anything they can do, you know, like with hemorrhage, there's a whole risk assessment for things that we can do to try to prepare, you know, identify women that are at higher risk. If she starts to bleed, we can add extra IV access. We can order blood products. We can, you know, give her medications that stop bleeding, all these things. But when this embolism hits, when an amniotic fluid embolism hits, there's not a way to predict it. And there's not a way to stop it once it's there. It's all you can do is treat mom, treat her symptoms, deliver the baby ASAP if it's still inside her when it happens. Other than that, you know, so they're definitely different monsters to look at, totally different in the way that they can be handled and treated.
So we've talked, Jill, today about blood clots and amniotic fluid embolisms. I think we've just scratched the surface in terms of what are some of the risks in the postpartum area. And you've mentioned the importance of detecting these symptoms, following the standard of care for treating them. That all relies on a nursing staff who are perceptive, who are skilled, who are analytical. Tell us about what is going on in the OB units related to training, orientation, staffing. We're talking now in August of 2021. God, I don't want to go back to last year.
No.
August of 2021. How has COVID impacted the healthcare systems that you're familiar with?
Well, like with everything else, meetings came to a grinding halt. So therefore, training groups of us together in rooms came to a grinding halt. Whereas meetings found digital ways to get things together so that planning and organizational resources and whatnot could still be used and moved forward. There hasn't been a good push forward yet to get simulation training back up and running. They start to do some with minimal attendance and we get another surge of COVID and then we can't do it again. And then we do a few more. And it's making it very tricky. We have a lot of young staff on the unit, not just our unit. I mean, this is affecting other units as well, ORs, ICUs, medical surgical units. It's affecting everyone everywhere. I know it is. I'm concerned that there's going to be a time up ahead that we are going to be looking at cases that they're going to be concerned about nurse negligence, you know, are not providing the care, failure to react, failure to identify. And my first question on every one of these is going to be, did this new nurse have proper training? Did she have proper orientation? When did she start working? Because I'm seeing it in the new nurses that I work with, near misses because they don't know what they don't know. And I don't hold that against them. They need to learn and we desperately need them to learn. But because of the social distancing that we're not allowed to, you know, get too many of us together in a room. And then we don't have as many educators. We need educators to educate the new people. We need the new people to help support the experienced staff that's there. The experienced staff is getting tired and worn down and frustrated. It's creating a cycle that should, by my opinion, be taken into consideration in the future when we start reviewing cases that are happening now or over the last year.
When I finished my master's degree, I spent 7 years in charge of the staff development department for a large acute care facility in New Jersey. And many of the issues that you're talking about were ones that we talked about. The staffing shortages, the pressure on new graduates. I was in that role from 1979 to 1986. So here we are, decades later, and the themes and the risks are present. It is a challenge in healthcare to keep experienced people, to keep them engaged, to keep them, to keep their wisdom in the clinical area and not have them burn out and leave. And that turnover, that cycle of the revolving door, people coming in, people coming out, new graduates, new young, inexperienced staff who come out of school partially prepared for their role, but not totally prepared. Is there anything encouraging? Maybe I shouldn't even ask you that question. Is there anything encouraging about this current situation that we can cling to as healthcare providers?
Well, in my local area, I'm assuming it's not just my local area, enrollment in the schools is still high. There's still waiting lists. So they're coming. The new staff are coming. There's applications, you know, going out. There's people applying, people being interviewed. A lot have left the bedside. But I like to hope they're just taking a break, you know, that the pandemic kind of beat them up a little bit and they just need a break. And then they're going to miss what they were doing, especially in my unit. They're going to miss what they were doing and they're going to come back. But there are more staff coming, and like every change we've seen, this will come either to an end or it'll come to a control that it becomes part of our new normal. I was not a nurse or working in medicine by far when HIV and AIDS became huge and prominent. My current director, though, she worked during that time, and she remembers a lot of staff members didn't want to work in healthcare, ran away from it, didn't want to take care of those patients. But it passed. It passed for healthcare. It passed for nurses and other staff. It became part of our norm, and it became controlled, and education overcame fear. So that'll happen again. In the back of my mind, I feel like COVID's going to become our new flu. Every year we'll need a new vaccine or a booster shot, but that's just me. That's just me guessing, mm-hmm. as it's part of our new norm.
Well, I know that our listener is going to want to know how to reach you. Say an attorney contacts a legal nurse consultant with an obstetrical case involving nursing care. What would be the best way for them to reach you?
My email address is the best way to reach me. I can. You want me to spell that out for you, Pat?
That would be great. Yeah, thank you.
J-G-U-E as in Edward, N as in Nancy, T H E as in Edward, R 924 at yahoo.com.
Perfect. Perfect. And is 924 your birthday?
Yeah. Well, somebody in IT somewhere in security is like, you silly person, never put any of your identifying factors into your stuff. But yep, it is. Birthday's coming up.
There are a lot of nurses who were born in September, I have to say, including myself. So I'm very cognizant of the value of having a September birthday.
It's a beautiful, beautiful time of year for a birthday. We're nice, balanced people.
And perfectionist, which makes us wonderful as legal nurse consultants, because we want to know about all those details and making sure that they're correct.
Yes. Details, details, details.
I called Johns Hopkins, where my husband and I get medical care, a couple of weeks ago, and the receptionist said, and what's your birth date? And I said, 9/10. And she said, that's my birthday. And we had a wonderful bonding time talking about what it's like to be a Virgo. She said, I do this. I said, yes, I do that too. And we're going back and forth, and I just had a feeling it gave her a boost for the morning to meet another September 10th birthday. So for any of you listening, if you're listening to this around September 10th, say happy birthday, Pat. I didn't tell you what year.
But, no, yes. Years we won't talk about.
No, years is a different issue.
Yep.
Well, thank you, Jill, so much for sharing your expertise with our audience, talking about some of the high-risk areas that can have a profound impact on a woman when these tragedies, these complications occur, and how this fits within the legal system. And you've also shared with us some of the strains, the stresses related to COVID and staffing and orientation that play into an analysis of a legal case. Thank you for being a guest on the show.
Thank you, Pat. Thanks for having me.
And for you who's listening, be sure to tell a couple of other legal nurse consultants about Legal Nurse Podcast. We bring you interviews every week. We have an opportunity for you to get the transcripts of our interviews by going to podcast.legalnursebusiness.com And if you would prefer to refer back to the information that we share in these podcasts, you can sign up to receive access to our transcripts and use this as another tool for increasing your knowledge as a legal nurse consultant. Thanks so much. This is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast. Tiffany Hines has been my guest on the podcast that we just recorded. Tiffany is a long-term care nursing expert witness who shares her expertise in this podcast about an environment that is unique unto itself, and that is the nursing home. Tiffany, what were some of the highlights of what we covered in your podcast?
We spoke about some interesting topics. We spoke about the MDS, which is a major medical record that be pertinent for an LNC to review if she has a nursing home case. We spoke about the common risk factors in the facility, falls, pressure ulcers, infections. We spoke about the Department of Health and how we can get them involved if we have a case and we need some pertinent records. Looking at the facility's annual survey, how is that an indicator of the quality of care that's being provided for a resident? We spoke about the roles of an LPN versus an RN and the importance it takes that, you know, communication is always the key. And despite the individual may be an LPN and not an RN, but they cannot assess, but they can describe what they're seeing. We spoke about CNAs and how, you know, a value they are to any facility. They are the foundation when it comes to providing care and staffing and everything regards to resident care. So we highlighted a lot of interesting topics.
We sure did. Be sure to get Tiffany Hines' podcast queued up on your listening device of choice or watch her program on Legal Nurse Business YouTube channel. She's going to take you into that nursing home and give you a different perspective of a unique type of case. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on legalnursebusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Join our community to get notified of each new episode and to receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. We appreciate you and your interest.